In this part of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He is chair of Harvard's African and African-American Studies Department. He is the author of a new book that's just out now that is a companion to a series that we'll be running on public television, and we will be running the show next month, February 3rd and 4th. It's the product of a series of interviews that he conducted with African Americans across the country and in different walks of life. And the book that we're talking about here this morning, America Behind the Color Line, takes those interviews and puts them in a kind of an essay form, almost as if that person was sitting down and just talking to you very directly about those same sorts of issues. It's published by Warner Books and is out now in bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. Also, the PBS series will air on our television station, WILL-TV, on February 3rd and 4th, those two nights between 8 and 10. And if you, no matter where you're listening, if there's a public station near you, I imagine they will also be running the show, and you can check local listings for the time. He's spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book. He's in Chicago, and will talk with us this morning. And, of course, as always, questions and comments are welcome. We always offer that opportunity. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep that program moving along. But of course, anyone who is watching, anybody who is listening, I guess I'm in TV mode there, anybody who's listening is welcome to call in. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. The number is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Gates, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Man, it's cold out here.
Yeah, it's a little brisk here, but that's, you know, it's January, it's the Midwest.
Yeah, and that's what I'm suffering from in this hotel in Chicago, but it's great to be on your program.
Well, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. Maybe you might want to talk just a little bit about how it is this project, this interview project, that led to both a PBS documentary and also the book that's companion, how that project got started.
Well, 1900, W.E.B. Du Bois, the greatest black intellectual of all time, wrote famously that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. So at the beginning of the 21st century, I wanted to ask and attempt to answer that question as well, but I didn't want to do it like the lordly Du Bois, just to sit down at my desk and make the pronouncement. I wanted to go around the country interviewing a wide cross-section of the African-American community, the rich and famous and powerful and most successful members of the community, but also the powerless, the homeless, those who live in despair, the anonymous, and sometimes the infamous. I went to Cook County Jail here in Chicago and interviewed prisoners and drug dealers, ex-drug dealers who most probably soon to be drug dealers again, single heads of households, mothers and grandmothers living together who were not married in the Robert Taylor homes, the infamous Robert Taylor homes, the synonymous with all that was wrong with public housing. And I was lucky enough to have BBC, BBC Two, and PBS fund the series, and I traveled around with the film crew. And the result is a four-part film series. Now, the book came about in a curious way. I was contracted to do a companion book, but which would have been essentially my analysis of what I saw. But the interviews were so rich. You know as well as I do, but I don't know if our listeners do, that if you might go for an interview, let's say Colin Powell, I interviewed him. You might spend an hour with Colin Powell, but only 2 minutes gets in a 50-minute, 55-minute film series.
Yeah.
So what about all that good footage and all that marvelous content? And I realized that what I could do was to transcribe the interviews and then to turn those interviews into essays. And so I could share this broad array of opinion with readers who wouldn't be privy to it in any other way. And the result is America Behind the Color Line. In fact, I wanted to create the effect that of overhearing a conversation between two black people, say at a barbershop or in a beauty parlor or in our living rooms with no outsiders around. There's a kind of cultural intimacy that leads to a level of openness and honesty which we often don't share with the broader American public when we're outside of our culture, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's the effect that I'd like to think that I achieved both in the film series and in the book.
Well, that's I think you make that. It's an important point you make, that this idea that maybe there are things that when black people get together and talk with one another that they say that they would not say in front of a more mixed kind of, in front of mixed company.
Yes.
So I guess then a really basic question might be, well, for those people who are not African American, whatever their heritage is, everybody else, and what is it that you would like them to know about what is most important to black Americans as they think about who they are and maybe what they're not yet but could be?
Well, I want all of the viewers of the film series and the readers of the book, black, white, yellow, and brown, to come away with the following observation, which was consistent throughout the interviews. For the African-American community, 35 years after the terrible death of Dr. King, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. The black middle class has almost quadrupled since April 1968, largely because of affirmative action. But the black underclass, as measured by one key index, and that is the percentage of black children who live at or beneath the poverty line, the black poverty rate, measured that way, is almost 40%. 4 out of 10 black kids live at or beneath the poverty line. That's the percentage it was the day Dr. King was killed. This is a paradoxical result. Everyone, during the civil rights era, thought that, my God, if the black middle class quadrupled in size, black poverty would go down proportionately. But black poverty remained the same. While some of us made it, in other words, most of us have not. So that, remember the famous Kerner Commission report in 1968, following the King riots? It concluded that there were two nations in America, one black, one white. At the beginning of the 21st century, we can conclude that there are two nations within the African-American community. The small, still too small, but growing community defined by the black middle class and the much larger black underclass. And this book is meant as a wake-up call both to America and to middle-class black Americans and to underclass black Americans, saying, you know, we have to take control of our fate. We have to change this situation. If we don't do something drastic now, both internally as black people in our community and externally, meaning through the federal government and corporations and job programs, then the class divide within the black community will be permanent and disproportionately permanent, and never the twain between these two classes shall meet.
I do think it's interesting that it emerges so strongly that I think African Americans would want all Americans to recognize the point that the role that their participation initially unwilling in the building of how important their involvement was in the building of the country.
Absolutely.
And that also that they would make this argument that says denying them economic opportunity today is not only does that hold back African Americans, but it cripples all of America, because you're saying to those people, well, we're not going to let you participate, and when you do that, not you affect them, but you affect everyone.
Well, it's true. Jesse Jackson is very eloquent in the book and on the film, and when he talks about a 300-year tax subsidy, a 300-year subsidy, in effect, that free African labor gave to the building of the United States. That's remarkable. I mean, it's a devastating fact, but it's true. So, you know, the country couldn't have become prosperous without this free or at least cheap, inexpensive source of labor. Most of us forget that. Most of us don't think about that. Your second point was best addressed by the philanthropist Daniel Rose, who started this brilliant program at a middle school in Harlem, which integrates the teaching of chess into the curriculum. He took over this school, which had the worst test scores in New York City, and it now has the best test scores in New York City because all the kids come and learn chess. And somehow this has had a magical, to me, transforming effect on the kids' attitudes. Well, Dan Rose, the man who funded this program, said to me, it costs $60,000 a year to house a prisoner at, say, the Cook County Jail. We need, and Harvard costs $35,000. It costs more to house a prisoner than to send a child to Harvard. We need to turn, he said, $60,000 a year tax eaters into $60,000 a year taxpayers. It is not only the morally correct thing to do to reach in and save the people in the inner city, it is the physically responsible thing to do. If we can do that, our society as a whole will be much better off. Another important aspect of this book is that it points fingers both outside and inside the community. And what do I mean by that? We know that the causes of poverty in the inner city are both structural and historical, but they're also both internal. They are behavioral. So what's that mean? It means that you can't enslave a people for 300 years followed by a century of de jure segregation and it not have an effect. And 35 years of affirmative action does not wipe out 300 years of economic exploitation. No one can say that with a straight face. But we made a beginning. But we don't need to curtail affirmative action yet. We need more affirmative action, not less affirmative action. We need a federal jobs program to give people hope again in the economic system. Flipping burgers at McDonald's is not a viable option for a family of four. That is not something that's going to encourage people to stay in school. We need school reform. Schools are like zoos. I mean, schools are sites of violence and chaos. I couldn't have learned in the environment in so many of our inner-city schools. We have to change the tax base allocation per student. The amount of money spent per student in an inner-city school should be exactly the same as the amount of money spent in the wealthiest white suburb per student, and that's not, of course, the way it is right now. We need a Marshall Plan for our cities, as the National Urban League calls for every year. If we can rebuild Iraq, which remains to be seen, quite frankly, we certainly can rebuild our inner cities. But at the same time, we need a moral revolution, a revolution in attitudes within the black community. The average age of a grandmother in Robert Taylor Holmes a few years ago was in the mid-30s. Think about that, man. That means 16-year-old girls are having babies and in multiple generations. At any given point in Chicago, well, right now, the black males between the ages of 20 and 24, 45% are both out of work and out of school, most of whom either didn't graduate or don't have real functional literacy. And in any given week in Chicago, only 45% of the black community is working in the adult population. Less than 5 out of 10 people has a meaningful job. Now, these attitudes are like the worst nightmare of the Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. If George Wallace and Orville Faubus had sat down in 1960 and said, how can we control black people without looking like we're controlling black people? All they had to do was say, well, we'll encourage them to have babies when they're teens, to drop out of school, to think that education is quote-unquote white and something that's not authentically black, to engage in gang violence, to sell drugs, use drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm saying is we cannot wait for Abraham Lincoln to come galloping down our inner-city streets on a white horse to save us. We have to start to save ourselves. We need after-school programs. We need to convince our people, to remind them of the attitudes that we had when I was growing up in the 50s. The blackest thing that you could do in the 1950s was to become an educated person. Getting an A in school was another a bullet shot in the heart of white racists. Becoming a doctor or lawyer was the hallmark of excellence in the black community, not becoming a basketball player or a football player. Martin Luther King and Thurgood Marshall were our heroes, and Mary McLeod Bethune, people like that. And not Hank Aaron and Willie Mays. As much as we prize them, no one confused their value to the future of our community with Dr. King and attorney Thurgood Marshall. We have lost our way as a people. We have internalized our own oppression. And unless black leaders like whomever, from whichever end of the ideological spectrum, whether it's Jesse Jackson and Sharpton or even Louis Farrakhan, no matter who it is, we all have to unite on one thing, that no white racist makes you get pregnant when you're 16. No white racist makes you do drugs. No white racist makes you not do your homework. And no white racist makes you drop out of school. And if we continue to do those things as a people, if we continue to say stupid things like I saw in a poll recently, inner-city kids surveyed, saying, list things white. And the three principal responses were getting straight A's in school, speaking standard English, and visiting the Smithsonian. If anyone had said anything like that when we were growing up in the 50s, your mother would have smacked you upside your head and sent you to a mental institution. Unless we change these attitudes among our own people, the class divide within the black community will be permanent, and Martin Luther King did not die for that.
Our guest is Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He is chair of Harvard's African and African American Studies Department. He's the author of a number of books, including a new one that's the product of a series of interviews that he did with African Americans across the country, different walks of life, people who are fortunate and people who are not. It's titled America Behind the Color Line. That's sort of the book form that it's been put into. It's a companion to a PBS documentary that will air, I'm sure, on all public television stations across the country, and we're going to be showing the program early in February. In fact, it'll be the first couple days, February 3rd and 4th, between 8 and 10. That's on WILL television, and wherever you're listening, whatever TV station, public TV station is near you, you check their listings. If you're interested in the book, America Behind the Color Line, published by Warner Books, he is in Chicago today, and indeed we'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the DuSable Museum of African American History, so you might want to stop by if you're there in the Chicago area. And, of course, questions welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, Charleston, we will go to, and that's our line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I lived through the 50s and 60s as a young person, and then as I continued on, I've heard these same things over and over again. The subjugation of blacks and other minorities in capitalist culture will not change until we change the culture, and that can only be changed through revolutionary activity to overthrow the bourgeoisie, to seize the means of production. I know I'm sounding like a Marxist, but this is what I am. And I am sorry that, you know, a lifetime of listening to folks who, and I remember Chicago radio in the old days, I think maybe a little time before 580, and I drove a truck at night and I listened to those things, and until they were all expended and suddenly change was on the horizon, and then Mr. Kerner come along, showed that lower class blacks were worse off, as well as lower class white and Native Americans and other folks who, through immigration or slavery, however, got to the shore, who stole this country from the Indians without remorse. And now the capitalist class is continuing upon their journey of ultimate enslavement of everything on this globe, including its peoples, its natural resources, and its hegemony, the hegemony of its class. And that, if we don't change that basic ingredient, then I am afraid that we are doomed to these recurring waves of new young people. And I know a few young black men in Chicago, and have had dialogue with those folk, and understand that each of these new and accruing generations are fed the same pop of, you know, the affirmative action, which, you know, I agree with your guest, David, that without those things, the subject would have went out of style, and blacks would be then relegated to the South and to ghettos in the big cities, like they pretty much still are. But it at least addressed the situation. Well, unless we do go to the bottom and dig out that entrenched bourgeois class who own everything. One of David's guests this past week was a man written a book about Mexico, and three families own all the wealth in that one, in that single country. How many families own all the wealth in this? 10? 9? We don't know, but that leaves everybody else drowning in misery and poverty in a land of plenty, which is one of the anomalies of the 1930s. James Cannon observed that, saying, you know, what is this? Well, we don't need capitalism as the root. The bourgeois class are those who enforce their edicts and their paradigm upon the rest of us, willingly or unwillingly.
Well, let's get a response from our guest to the analysis of the caller.
The question is, can the capitalist system be reformed to accommodate the economic health of the African-American community? There's not going to be a Marxist revolution in the United States. I mean, if there is, it will be a total shock to me, and I think just about everyone else. I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that communism is dead as a doornail. And from the way it looked to me, communism wasn't such a great system in the Soviet Union or in Cuba or in communist China. It's just not. And I mean, even China is abandoning communism as an economic system, and I think that as the bourgeoisie grows, the demand for democracy will grow as well, and it's certainly long overdue. So we can't, in my opinion, with all due respect to that very articulate caller, I don't want the members of the African-American community to be the last Marxists in the Western world. I don't think that that's realistic. What we have to do is humanize the face of capitalism. Our goal is Franklin Raines, the first black CEO of a Fortune 500 company, Fannie Mae, puts it in the film series, is that we have to have the same percentage of the black poor as the white poor, the same percentage of the black rich as the white rich, the same percentage of the black middle class and black working class as the white middle class and white working class. And to do that, we need the program that I outlined. We need a comprehensive jobs training program that creates meaningful jobs for a global, highly technological world economy. We need school reform. We need moral attitudinal reform. There's always going to be a bell curve of class in any society. There are always people who are rich and they're poor. We need a much more humane system, however. I heard yesterday on CNN, 43 million people did not have health insurance in America. That's inexcusable, and we should be ashamed of ourselves, and that should be corrected. When I was at the Cook County Jail, I asked sort of the sub-warden who showed me around, how many people in prison, in his prison, should be reassigned because of drug addiction and drug-related problems to a medical facility rather than prison? He said 70%, and he's overwhelmingly black, 70% of the prisoners should be in a medical facility. We need prison reform. We need that urgently. We need these things, new and better literacy training for both the mothers and the grandmothers if they're in their 30s and unwed in these inner cities. Two generational job training programs, literacy training programs, reading programs, computer training programs. But we cannot sit idly and wait for the communist or Marxist revolution, because that's not happening. And frankly, I'm not one of the people who wants it to happen. I want a more humane form of capitalism. I think that the entrepreneurial spirit is ingrained in the human community. I think we all thrive when we feel that we're rewarded for our hard work. I think there's nothing to be embarrassed about. In fact, just the opposite, we need more black entrepreneurs, not less black entrepreneurs, and that's why I don't know if you had a chance to read Lenora Fulani's interview in my book or to see the film, but she, who's a radical activist, has started a sort of black entrepreneurial school in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Kids who have never even been to Wall Street, who had never seen the World Trade Center before they saw it being destroyed by the terrorists on TV, are being trained in the 12-week program. So these are kids who have fallen through the cracks in the school system. She teaches them through performance theory to learn to walk the walk and talk the talk of Wall Street, and she has 100% placement rate at getting them apprenticeships at Wall Street firms after a 12-week period. She jokes when she addresses them on the first day, she says, for the next 12 weeks, I'm going to teach you how to be white. I'm going to teach you how to say ask and not ask a question. I'm going to teach you how to tie a tie. I'm going to teach you how to wear a suit, how to look white people in the eye and shake their hand, how to perform. It's a brilliant, brilliant program, and it's working marvelously, and I feature that among other meaningful programs for reform in the inner city.
Yeah.
In my film series and in the book.
The very first conversation here that you have, or the first, as it's presented kind of in an essay form, is Colin Powell. Certainly, yeah, probably about the most prominent in public life, one of the most prominent African Americans in the United States.
The most prominent in history, most powerful public official we've had.
And what strikes me about this is, he talks about the fact that he goes into, when he's doing his work, wherever he goes, he says, I walk into a room, people see a black man, but they also see the American Secretary of State, and they know that I'm not coming to them as a black man, I'm coming to them as a representative of the American people,
right,
the President of the United States. So, and he, it seems to be very clear about talking about what constitutes his identity and doesn't want his race to be the primary thing that constitutes his identity. At the same time, I guess I think about the kind of thing that I've heard often from African Americans who are trying to get across the point. They say something like, for me, there may be many things that I am, but there's one thing that I'm always going to be and I can't not be, and that is black.
That's right. We say, the expression that the larger American community has, what is it? Two things you have to do, pay taxes and die?
Yeah, the only things you have to do are pay taxes and die. Yeah.
We say the three things you always have to do, pay taxes, stay black, and die,
yeah.
Because you can't escape. What Colin Powell says is, I ask him specifically, when you walk into a room, as you'll see in the film series, when you walk into a room, Sharon is sitting there, Arafat are sitting there, and you're trying to broker peace in the Mideast. What's the first thing these guys, when they look up from the table and see you walk in the room, what's the first thing they see? And he said, they see me as a black man. But then they see all the power of the greatest military machine in the history of mankind, and all the power of the White House and the American flag. Even Colin Powell cannot escape being black. None of us can. And, by the way, I know Colin Powell. He doesn't want to escape. Colin Powell's a get-down brother. When Harry Belafonte accused him of being a house Negro, it really was disgusting to me because, A, Harry didn't know Colin, and second, it's just not true. He is a very, very race-conscious black man, and as he goes on to say in that interview, we have a special obligation, which our white brothers and sisters don't necessarily have, to the white poor. The black successful members of the community have a special historic and moral obligation to those who are left behind. So I would say that this generation of the black middle class is keenly aware of race, but is also genuinely confused about what to do about the problems facing the inner city. And face it, many people are nouveau riche, first generation. They feel psychologically that they're one paycheck away from going back to the ghetto. Black people historically have not accumulated much wealth yet. It takes a while to learn how to be generous, to learn how to give back, and I think that now the time has come for that, and that's what I'm on a campaign to try to generate, and I'm not alone.
The book and the series is divided into these major sections, and I want to ask about one of them and why it is that it interests you. You say in the book, you write the fact that maybe the two biggest surprises about the collective behavior of members of the black middle class, you say first, their deep and abiding embrace of black culture, but the other thing is their desire, so the desire of many to live in their own neighborhoods with other middle class black people and to do so in growing numbers back home in the South, reverse migration. Why do you think that that's such a significant phenomenon?
Look, it astonished me. I mean, first I think we should tell our listeners that the series is in four parts, and one part is called Ebony Towers, about the new black middle class, people like Colin Powell and Vernon Jordan and Blacks on Wall Street and the very successful black people. One part's on the opposite economic extreme, the inner city, and it's called The Streets of Heaven, and it's about the South Side of Chicago. Indeed, it's about the Robert Taylor Homes and the nightmare existence there, which led to their destruction, as you know. I think as of this morning, there's only one building left of all those vast array of high-rises that existed from the 1960s. One part's on Black Hollywood, and I wanted to see if Denzel and Halle Berry winning Academy Awards spelled the end of racism in Hollywood. The answer is no, it does not. But one part is, as you just said, on the curious phenomenon of successful black people, middle, upper middle class black people, moving from the North and the West back to the South. Now, this is a trend that began in the 80s, but really took off in the 1990s. And Atlanta is the mecca for the new black middle class. And these people are moving from white neighborhoods to all black neighborhoods, million-dollar homes, all black country clubs, all black swimming pools, all black fraternal organizations. It's astonishing, all black churches. You could look from now till doomsday in black literature and black oral culture and black music, and you'll find a zillion songs saying, follow the North Star, follow the drinking gourd. The drinking gourd was a metaphor for the Big Dipper, and that, of course, involves the North Star. Go north, you know, escape the southern racism. But you will not find one that says, black people, find your freedom in Alabama and Mississippi. Leave New York. Leave Boston. Leave Chicago and go back home. But that's what's happening. I think if Martin Luther King came back from the grave, he'd be astonished that that's what's happening. A, that the movement is the reverse. And that B, that black people are insisting on the right to live in their own communities. And so I ask in the film series, is this, would Martin Luther King approve of this? Would he find it ironic? And I do a great interview with Maya Angelou in her home in Atlanta. She has a couple homes, one in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, one in Atlanta. And she said, black people are coming out of exile. That, in effect, we have been in exile from our true home, the South, for 90 years since migration started, 90-plus years. And now we have the self-confidence, the economic wherewithal, the means to return to our native grounds. And I do a great interview with Morgan Freeman at the beginning of that film. And Morgan Freeman, who's so wealthy and so successful. I mean, this man has played both president and God, so I guess you can't beat that for A-list roles. Morgan Freeman lives in Mississippi. He could live in Bel Air or Beverly Hills or wherever else he wanted to live, and he lives at his home place in Mississippi. And I talked to him about why he would do that. And then I go to those homes by way of Memphis and Birmingham. I go to Atlanta, and I go to these very, very wealthy black neighborhoods, and I actually interview people, and they say, we want the cultural comfort of living with other black people. We want our children to see positive role models. Deidre Wolf, one of the people I interviewed, said, I wanted to move in a black neighborhood and not have the property values go down. All of us can understand that. It's the difference between enforced segregation in the 60s and 50s and historically in America, which is what de jure segregation was all about, and willing association. The right to live with other people. Now, if these black people said no white people could move in, I would be at the head of the march protesting their own racism. But, you know, they're wide open about white people moving in if white people want to move in. But as they say, they see white people coming to this neighborhood looking to model home there in the neighborhood and then driving around. When they look at the swimming pools, they see everybody black. When they look at the front lawn, they see everybody black. When they look at the barbecues in the backyard, they see everybody black. And I said, well, what do they do then? And he said, they press on their foot on the accelerator and get the hell out of the neighborhood. So maybe the neighborhoods are all black because of the residues, which still exist, of course, of white racism.
Well, given, now just raises this question in my mind, given the fact that African Americans have been the most reliable constituency for the Democratic Party, and given the fact that over the last several decades we've seen a real swing in the South from a dominance of Democrats to dominance of Republicans, mm-hmm. if we have middle-class African Americans moving in significant numbers back to the South, do the numbers, are they significant enough to have any kind of noticeable impact on the political character of the South?
Well, the southern states are full of black people anyway. Our problem is that black people don't vote. I wanted to do a piece for the New Yorker a couple years ago, which I never finished. But come to think of it, I want to do that. I went around asking prominent white people, if you were black, what's the first thing you would do to save your people? And my next door neighbor was John Kenneth Galbraith. So I went next door and I asked Ken, you know, what would you do? And he said, get your people to vote. He said, I would get my people to vote. If you would vote in proportion to your numbers, you would have a hell of a lot of strength. If we voted, we would really have political clout, but we don't vote. There are 35 million African Americans. So imagine how many of our voting age, and we don't vote. And if we voted and then made the political parties beg us for our vote, earn our vote instead of just being blindly loyal to the Democratic Party, but then, you know, and what choice do we have given the Republican? I mean, if the Republican president's against affirmative action, that's it for the black vote, you know. Forget it. I mean, we're not going to go that way. But if we voted, they would have to modify their policies in order to earn the black vote. And that would produce a dramatic effect. So Russell Simmons, who's also in the film, Russell Simmons is leading a voter registration drive using all the tools at his considerable disposal. And I hope that it's effective because that would be essential to transforming our position within the American citizenry.
We have a caller to talk with in Stell, and that's on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
good morning, David and Dr. Gates.
Good morning.
I've greatly appreciated your work over the years, especially that movie series when you went to Africa.
Oh, thank you.
I had a couple of comments bouncing off of a previous caller who spoke of a certain communist ideals. And I have to say, I don't want to say creptitude, but I mean, after years of living life, I agree with the communist principles. I mean, people-centered ideals instead of profit-centered ideals. To me, that is the main difference. Not that we would want a communist system, because they became as corrupted as any other system.
That's right, they did.
But, you know, if we look at what is better for the greater good of the people, then we would have to think differently, I think. I don't know if you're aware that in the desert of the United States, there remains today certain vestiges of the CCC program, where certain parts of the desert are now covered with greenery because of this work. When they put the young men to work who had no other work, they built infrastructure. They built highways and bridges and parks. I think our national parks that we have today were mostly built by the CCC.
Right, federal programs for the unemployed in the 1930s.
Yes, well, we need those people to be employed, and we also need the desert to bloom, and we need, you know, road improvements and things like that. That doesn't seem to be entering anyone else's that those are possibilities that would be valuable for the whole culture. We're just thinking of profit. Job training for what? For McDonald's? I mean, entrepreneurial training, yes. That would be valuable.
It's got to be meaningful job training. Without,
that's so often is in the mind of the teacher rather than in the life of the student.
It's true, but the what you're describing could very well be part of this comprehensive jobs program. I mean,
yes,
if it worked in the 30s, why couldn't it work again?
Absolutely.
But there's no will among the Republicans to do that. There's no will whatsoever. That's why the Democratic Party and those of us who love justice and equality and freedom have to insist on those kind of programs being resurrected again.
Absolutely.
And look, this ridiculous thing with Bush and company talking about this marriage bill. Billions of dollars to encourage people to get married. Why? Because they're homophobic. Because they're so homophobic that they want to defend the institution of marriage, they say, by investing these billions of dollars. Put those billions of dollars into a jobs program, the kind of thing that you're talking about. Let's put our people to work, give them an investment in their own future and in the system again. That is the only way to go.
The region where they live. I mean, just think if all the places, the rundown places that are existing in America today, if they had trees being planted or things being built,
yes, absolutely,
would improve everybody.
The people who live in the inner city don't want to live in those conditions.
Right.
I never met one person who loved being poor and who loved all the violence. They just don't know how to get out, and that's what we have to help them find out.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Henry Louis Gates, Jr., is chair of Harvard's African and African-American Studies Department. His new book, it's titled America Behind the Color Line. It's published by Warner Books. It is a companion to a PBS documentary that will be airing on our television station in early February. This is February 3rd and 4th from 8 to 10 on WILL television, and I'm sure on a lot of other public stations as well. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested because part of the section does have to do with Hollywood and images of African Americans' popular culture. A little earlier this week, I had the chance to talk with Charles Burnett, who was here visiting the campus.
Oh, I love Charles Burnett.
Well, for people who know about film or who write about cinema, say one of the things that they say about him is he may be America's greatest unknown director.
It's true.
Because people are not familiar with his work, even though it has been critically acclaimed And some of the films have gotten some attention, like To Sleep With Anger, which is
right.
A lot of people think maybe his best
yeah.
movie. And he's continuing to work, and his work is out there. But, you know, we talked a lot about his interest in telling stories about real people and their real daily lives, and wanting to project a certain kind of image of Black Americans and the African American family, and just how difficult it has been to try to be able to tell those kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that the question I'm going at here is what role do you think images of African Americans in popular culture play, both for, you know, the way African Americans think of themselves, but also about how other Americans think about Black Americans?
Well, I think that we used to think if only we could get some positive role models on TV or in film that would immediately transform white attitudes toward Black people. But do you know what the number one show in the 80s was in white apartheid South Africa? Guess what the number one TV show was?
I don't know.
It was The Cosby Show.
Now, that's irony for you, isn't it?
Yeah, all these white races would come home and say, God, if our Africans were just like Bill and Claire,
we wouldn't have any problems.
We wouldn't have any problems. So it's a lot more complex than one might think. But it is very important to see a wide range of roles for Black people. Obviously, things are much better in Hollywood now than they were in the days of Butterfly McQueen playing that that no-brain maid in Gone with the Wind, or Mammy, who gets the Academy Award for playing Mammy, reinforcing stereotypes about Black women, or Willie Best, or Step and Fetch It. Obviously, things are much better, but they're not where they should be. In fact, in my film series, there are two things that are totally startling to me. The first is that Hollywood is still color-struck. What's that mean? I interviewed brown skin actresses, B actresses. That doesn't mean they're bad. It just means they don't make as much money as, say, Halle Berry and Denzel. So I go on a Sunday afternoon to one apartment. There are about 30 people there. Most of them are Black women. Beautiful, beautiful people. And they say they cannot get top parts because they're not light-complected like Halle Berry, who has that kind of Lena Horne look. And I said, is it true of Black directors and producers or only white directors and producers? And they say it's true of Black and white producers, whereas Black men have broken through who are dark-complected. Black women have not. So there's still that residue of racism. And then I interview the great producer, Arnon Milchan, one of the most powerful people in Hollywood, one of the few people who can actually greenlight a film, in his house in Malibu, next door to David Geffen's house. And I said, Arnon, teach me about the economics of race at the box office. He said, okay, this is the example. Jodie Foster stars in Panic Room. Let's say it makes $100 million. I said, okay. He said, if I had cast Halle Berry in the same part, the film would have only made $50 million because white people are not interested in seeing a Black woman and her son being terrorized by burglars. I said, why? And he said, well, because the heroine for the average American is the girl next door, and the girl next door with blonde hair, blue-eyed, is a cheerleader. She is not a Mexican. She does not have an accent, and she is definitely not Black. I said, okay, that's cold, but let's go on with it. I said, what about the perfect love story script? And we'll cast Denzel and Halle. They got Academy Awards, big box office hits. He said, right. They get $20 million a film. I said, good for them. He said, yeah, but there's one small problem. I said, what? He said, the film would only generate $50 million. That means this film will never be made because nobody would make any profit. I said, all right, let's cast Russell Crowe with Halle Berry in the same film with the same script. He said, Eureka, it would make $200 million, maybe $300 million, because people love to see that kind of voyeuristic racial race crossing when it's a white male and a Black woman. But you notice Denzel never sleeps with his white heroines, never, with that film with Julia Roberts. All the brothers sitting there saying, go for it, Denzel, go for it. You know, I hope you finally get over, brother. And they basically shake hands and they walk away. In the history of Hollywood, no two leading characters who are that intimate do not end up in bed together unless it is Denzel Washington and a white woman. This is still a function. It's not a function of the producers and directors of Hollywood. It's a function of the racism out there that's determining the box office, because it is true, as I say in the film, the most important color in Hollywood is green. These guys would make a film about anything if it
would make money. Yeah,
They have no ideological bias. They do not care. They care about money.
We have about maybe 5-6 minutes left. We have suddenly we have a number of callers, and I'm sure we won't be able to get all of them, but we'll try and get one or two. Next in line is in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Yeah, since you're talking about films, the Afro-American Research Program here showed a film by, astonishingly, Roger Corman that was made in 62 and lost money. It was called The Intruder, and it's a dramatization of integration of a school, and I'm still recovering from it. It's an amazing film, and I think it was shown on Mystery Science Theater recently, and lampooned, which is really outrageous. I guess they saw the Roger Corman name on it, and William Shatner plays a fascist in it who comes down to agitate, the first outside agitator, I guess. But I recommend it highly. I was actually floored by it. But what I wanted to call about was sort of when you were talking to the woman earlier about CCC and that kind of thing.
Yes.
I mean, we have this. Bush just cut all of the job training and then announces, you know, a third of what he cut, and then goes and stumps on it, and nobody declaims it.
I know.
And then he announced, to be compassionately conservative, he announces money, faith-based money, for prison, you know, the parolee effort.
Right.
Which is mainly, to me, it's callous, and nobody's pointing that out either.
I know. We have a failure, a breakdown of the leadership, but I'm talking about the black leadership as well as white leadership.
Well, you know, this faith-based money, he's seeing it as a way of shoring up his black Republican vote.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's...
Because you can always appeal to black people through God, through Jesus. But on the other hand, black people in the end are still black, and we still are voting overwhelmingly for the Democratic president. And I do not think that George Bush is going to get double-digit inroads into the African-American community.
Well, when the margin is this close, though, what he peels off is more important than anything else.
No, it's absolutely...
Thank you.
It's absolutely true. It's disgusting, and I agree with you. I also thought it was disgusting for him not to go to Martin Luther King's grave, which he did on Dr. King's birthday. I applauded that. But then the next day, to a point that the judge, who had such a mix of... What was his name? Pickering?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The judge Pickering, to use his power to appoint him... after the congressional session was over, was disgusting. That was almost like saying to all of you who are worried about me becoming too liberal by going to Dr. King's grave, don't worry, I'm still one of you. It was so callous, and it was as callous symbolically as the cutback in the jobs program was economically. And it's just disgusting, man. I hope that a strong Democrat emerges from this circus in New Hampshire, and that we can unite behind one articulate, charismatic, morally based leader who cares about compassion, who cares about the maximum degree of social and economic justice for the average American, and that's not what we have in the Bush administration. Never before, in my time at least, have you seen the interests of corporate America so nakedly represented and defended than we're seeing today in the White House? And it's just not right.
Yeah. Let's go to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I work with, I have worked with the public school system in this area, and the discrimination I witnessed amongst the administration and the teachers was just incredible, you know, and it twinkles down, I guess. It reflects on children's.
What do you mean, white administrators?
System. Oh yeah.
Mhm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like in most schools in this area, the majority of the teachers are white, you know.
Hmm.
And like I was working in a bilingual program, I'm bilingual, you know, I mean, how do you deal with those kind of things, you know, when the structure is just so set that that people of color lose their dignity, their knowledge isn't recognized, you know, and taken into consideration. Like, you know, I was working together with another teacher who was the ESL teacher. She teaches English as a second language.
Mm-hmm.
This woman doesn't speak a second language. She only speaks English, and she's teaching English to Latino students. And I was the bilingual teacher. I'm bilingual. And when the new program was being created for the next year, I was completely omitted from the process. You know, and it's like, I'm just tired of fighting the battles, you know?
But you can get help on any instance of racism. I mean, there's still state human rights commissions, and you can call them in. I mean, you can file reports on documented discrimination, and I would encourage you to do that, because we don't need that. We've come too far for you to have to suffer like this for racist treatment. And so I would encourage you to look into the various agencies that you could complain to. I mean, there have to be mechanisms for you to file your grievance, and I would encourage you to do that.
I'm going to have to jump in. My apologies to the caller and to the last. We're just going to have to stop because we've used our time.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. I know you're traveling and you're in Chicago and have been doing speaking and so forth, so I'm glad you could spend the hour with us.
I wouldn't have missed it, Ben. I love Champaign-Urbana, so it's great. Thank you so much.
Well, you can come see us sometime.
I'll be there.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr., he's chair of Harvard's African and African-American Studies Department. The book we've mentioned is titled America Behind the Color Line. It's published by Warner Books. This is a companion to a PBS documentary that will air on our television station February 3rd and 4th from 8 until 10. That's on WILL TV.